The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Kimon Felix is a poet and an essayist, and also a contributing writer at The Cut. Her poetry collection, Build Yourself a Boat, was longlisted for the National Book Award in Poetry and shortlisted for the Lambda Literary Award, among other honors. In her new book, she reflects upon early difficulties to explore the trauma of past troubles and the concepts of self-love and acceptance. This evening, she will be joined in conversation with Sharon G. Flake. Ms. Flake is the recipient of 2 Coretta Scott King Awards and is the author of more than a dozen books, including her 1998 debut, the modern classic novel, The Skin I'm In. Please welcome our guests to the Free Library.
Hello. How exciting.
Hello.
How are you? So I've told Sharon this over the phone, but just in case it didn't completely sink in, we are mostly here to honor Sharon. All of my books are here, but I was telling some friends earlier that when I was a little girl, when I was like 8, 9, 10, I was obsessed with these books. I'm hard pressed to find, especially young black girls of my age who didn't also fall in love with her books at that time. And I credit Begging for Change explicitly as one of the books that made dyscalculia possible and that made me possible as a person. So part of what I want to do today is talk in different ways about how Sharon kind of helped bring the book to life, and also talk about the kinds of characters that she's developed, and also her life and her career and how we got here and what it means to like be sitting next to me, I guess.
This never happens. I want you guys to know. And I've been thinking about it since you called me, because It never happens. When you have a new book, you want somebody else to come and talk about you and your new book. So, yeah. After I read what you sent, I kept thinking, like, this is wrong. I said, well, this is not right. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
You blessed me, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, fine. Let's start then, right? Like, we could do this, like, love eyes all day. But so one of my favorite characters, Ever Written, is Raspberry.
She's my second most popular one.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Malika from The Skin I'm In is the first one.
Malika is the second one. Raspberry was so important to me because it was the first book I read. Begging for Change was the first time I read a book where a young black girl got in trouble. She was in trouble and was problematized by her community. In some ways, rightfully so. She, like, stole from her best friend. That's, like, kind of shady, right? But she was redeemable. By the end of the book, her friends still loved her. Her mother still loved her. The people around her didn't think that she was bad or, like, fundamentally broken. She had just made a mistake, and she was being given the chance and the opportunity to learn from it, right? And to see herself through a different lens. So I wanted to ask you, where did that character come from? How did you conceive of her? And why did she need to be redeemed in the end?
Well, I'm going to tell you this because, mm-hmm. you know, this is the first work I've read by you, and it's amazing, and it's so well-crafted, and it's so textured and so layered. There's so much there. that I imagine that you really thought a lot about that. Mm-hmm. I'm a different kind of writer because of my own particular fears, mm-hmm. right? Like, I don't want to know what's up there because I'm afraid that I won't be up to the challenge. So I just jump in. And so she didn't, I don't know where she came from. I really know very little bit about a book when I start writing, mm-hmm. which is I did the first book and I said, okay, I should write a second book. I can't think of anything else. And then the first book was about a girl who loved money. Mm-hmm. And so then I wrote that one and I had two directions. And I said, which direction should I go? My daughter said, okay, go this way. Uh-huh. In terms of being redeemable, I don't think I ever thought about redemption. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have a master's mm-hmm. in English, right? In fiction or nonfiction or poetry. And so, but I do have an undergraduate degree in English.
Which is just as valid.
So I don't particularly think like that. What I do think about is that everybody has something good about them. Mm-hmm. Raised in a family where, you know, we helped take care of our grandfather, my father, when we were little, helped take care of my mother's father and her grandfather. And we have nieces that we raised and nephew, right? And so that people are going to make mistakes. And I think I always felt like I needed forgiveness. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure for what particular, but just walking down the street and I'll let you talk. But I remember my father, we had to speak to people who were homeless. We had to speak to people who didn't have money. And we were always told that we weren't any better. Mm-hmm. So when you have that philosophy, mm-hmm. then I don't think you see anybody's life, hopefully, that they can't get back up again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that resonates a lot with me, especially in writing this book. I don't know that I thought too much about redeemability either. What I thought about was about forgiveness, for sure. And I thought a lot about, like, how does one facilitate forgiveness in a story where forgiveness is not usually granted, right? So in a breakup, for instance, right, or in a love story, usually that story ends in a pretty binary fashion where it's like, this person has done something wrong, this person was innocent, and this person has awful karma for the rest of their life. And while I still believe that somebody in my past has got some awful karma coming to them, at the same time, it felt impossible to write this story and to think about this story without thinking about my own flaws, my own faults, and really trying to kind of exercise them, bring them out and lay them out and iron them out and make them clear. And the reason why I keep crediting Money Hungry and Begging for Change for that is because when I was really young and trying to figure out what it meant to be a good girl, what it meant to be a good person, mm-hmm. I didn't see any examples of that in the books that I was reading. Any examples of what it meant for a girl like me to be a good girl.
Right.
I'm from the hood. I don't have a lot of resources. I go to awful schools. I'm a neurodivergent smart kid mm-hmm. who was being pushed to the margins at every opportunity possible. And I got into a lot of trouble in part because of my neurodivergence and also just because I was really frustrated. I could tell that the system kind of wasn't set up for me to be a happy and healthy person. And when I read Raspberry, she also was a young woman who had a lot of self-awareness. She understood that, like, the fact that she needed money that bad, mm-hmm. that it was a systemic thing, a systematic thing. Mm-hmm. She was like, my mom doesn't have money because this and this happened.
Right.
My family needs this money because if we don't, then we're going to get kicked out of our home. Right. I need money because I need to be able to care for myself in the basic ways. I don't have that. So now I need to figure out how to get it. Right.
She had to figure out how to get. Now, remember, in the first book, she didn't steal at all.
Mm-hmm.
The second book, she did a little.
Yeah.
But I'm also a girl from the hood. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in a neighborhood that I thought, oh, you don't know who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So a librarian lived across the street. Somebody ran numbers lived on the other side of the street.
Right.
My father worked digging ditches. There was a cop. There was, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Miss Connie, I always say Miss Connie, Mr. Earl, when it rained, I could still see them. Laying, you know, she's laying on his lap and mm-hmm. she's he's laying in her lap because she's picking his bumps and getting, you know, getting the pimples out. Right. And that was love. I mean, you know what I mean? So right. The things that I think people didn't see.
Right.
So again, it was easy to see that there are all kinds of people who live in those communities.
That's right.
Right. So it was easy for me, I guess, to create a person that I thought, okay, you have these problems and these issues, mm-hmm. but at the end, you still, again, are redeemable. You right. have some qualities about you.
Yeah.
That people might not see, especially if you're African American exactly. and female.
And I saw all of that in Raspberry in particular, Malika, obviously. But I think that book was like said that it was very clear, right? Like you were supposed to, Malika was supposed to be humanized because she was being dehumanized by the color of her skin.
Really?
You didn't think so?
Yeah, but I don't think about I don't think about stuff like that when yeah. I write. People think I do. But I have a very odd.
That's because you're a genius.
Well, I don't know about that. But I have a very odd, like when I'm writing, I am sort of Malika. I don't like, mm-hmm. right? So I'm navigating right. that landscape of mm-hmm. really differently.
Right.
But you, what I love about your work was, and at one point I thought, I see myself in a work, after you told me.
Yeah.
But not like a mirror reflection, mm-hmm. but it was something that was so clear. And I think my work is so accessible and so clear. And that's what I like. But I think you're dealing with a lot of, to me, complex mm-hmm. information like mathematics, mm-hmm. which I get nervous about.
Well,
and, right. And having, and I had never heard that anybody could be like, we know trauma can make you mm-hmm. cut.
Right.
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 We know trauma can make you maybe overindulge in sex mm-hmm. or overindulge in drugs, mm-hmm. but that trauma could impact how on such a level, like how you think about math, how you mm-hmm. process math. Mm-hmm. I thought it was genius to not only that you dealt with it, but yeah. you can articulate it in a way that I could understand and not scratch, because I am really nervous about math. I am.
I'm nervous about math too. And that's part of the reason why I wrote the book, right? But that's also why, again, like why Raspberry was so important to me, because she was terrified. She did not want to actually have to be dealing with money at that level. The math was not mathing. Mm-hmm. But she felt like it needed to happen in order for her to protect herself, protect her family, right? And in the end, she made some mistakes, though one could offer the analysis that they were not mistakes. They were like very sensible actions that any person would take mm-hmm. in the same situation. But we'll call them mistakes for the sake of this conversation. She made some mistakes, and in the end, and through the process of making that mistake, she was able to see herself very clearly. And I feel like reading that account and seeing that self-analysis, even if you didn't intend for it to be that way, mm-hmm. watching her do that kind of work in the book to try to understand, why am I so obsessed with money? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why do I care so much, right? The thing is, you ask yourself, like, what 10 or 11-year-old is having that kind of conversation with themselves? And you realize every 10 and 11-year-old in their heads, right, with themselves, which is why you don't hear it. And I think
how you do it so magnificently. You really do.
Yeah.
I mean, at some points, I feel like this is a therapist talking to me, mm-hmm. literally, mm-hmm. right? And at other points, I feel like I'm looking into a little girl who's been traumatized, who's been assaulted mm-hmm. in the beginning, a teenager mm-hmm. who is, you know, really has figured out the game with professional institutions mm-hmm. and is sitting back. Now, did you really do that? Mm-hmm. Did you really? Is sitting back thinking, what do I need to do so they don't lock me up?
Oh, yeah. I really did that. I really did that. And a lot of that kind of like cognitive thinking came from reading books like yours so early and so easily, right? Being able to kind of take a step back and look at the landscape of the world and think, okay, well, what happens to girls like me, right? How does this, I've seen it before, I've read it, I know all the ways that this is gonna go down. How do I protect myself? And in large, a lot of the professionals that I worked with when I was a young person, and I mean this with the utmost respect, were not very smart people. They were not very smart, and they were not very committed to actually being present intellectually for young people and for young people like me, right? And it could be that they just weren't smart in our sessions and they were smart for other people, but they didn't actually want to understand what was going on with me. They wanted to diagnose me so that they could marginalize me once again. And whether it was because of my mom, the books I was reading, or just me being me, I could see right through it, and I wanted to gamify it. It was like, if I have to be here all the time, if I have to come to therapy against my own will, knowing that you don't actually care about me, I have to gamify this, right? Otherwise, what happens? Gamify it to keep myself safe, and gamify it to keep myself from getting bored, because I know that my healing is important, but I also know that it's not as important to you as it is to me.
Did race have anything to do with that,
race
do you think?
Race had everything to do with it, for sure. I think, and I've said this before, that if I were the young person who is in this book, if that young person were a young white person who lived in a middle-class community and was raised in a place that had more resources, there is no way. What I have been diagnosed with over the last 10 years, there is no way that any of that would have been missed, right? Black girls get misdiagnosed, especially for things like autism, all the time. And there's a reason. And it's not just because we don't know the symptoms, or black girls have different symptoms. We don't have different symptoms. It's not, you can't pathologize us that way, right? We have the same symptoms. They show up in different ways because of a lack of resources, because of the way that we are positioned systematically. And I carry a lot of resentment about that. I know that my life could have been radically different, and should have been, if I had just gotten like the basic care that I see a lot of young white people get. I have enough white friends who are neurodivergent and different to be able to know. Like one of my really, really close friends, one of my best friends, she and I we're extremely similar. We have a very similar sort of like anxiety, very similar output of how our anxieties work, the same kind of chaotic energy, especially when we're anxious. And this girl has been to over 30 therapists, has gone to all types of retreats and shit when she was a kid. I mean, they were giving it up in Chicago. She was running these fucking psycho streets. Me, the minute you say that you're cutting yourself, they throw you in the hospital. Mm. That's it. She was cutting herself. They didn't throw her in the hospital. Mm. They were like, something's wrong. She needs care. So we need to keep her home and try to evaluate what that care looks like.
And so throwing you in the hospital doesn't equate to she needs care? What did that equate to?
No. What it equates to is like there is an understood way that we deal with madness, right? And like madness is a capital M. It's an understood way that we deal with madness, and that way is that we put it away, and we put it in the room, and we close the door, and we wait for it to be done. I'm going to give you a 2-week stay. By the end of this 2 weeks, if you're not better, you're staying longer.
So get yourself together in 2 weeks.
Get yourself together in 2 weeks. But what happens in those 2 weeks is bananas, right? The kind of trauma that you must undergo in those 2 weeks, right? And that's part of the reason why in the book I wrote so extensively about that long stay that I had when I was 13, because that is when it broke through for me. That's when I learned that I had to game my way out of it in order to be able to leave those doors. I was like, I'm going to be, after that first week where they were like, yeah, you have to stay in another week. And I knew that no one had attended to me. Like, no care had actually happened. After that first week, I was like, oh, this is up to me. If I want to get out of here, I got to get out of here. It was almost like choose your own adventure. It was very scary. Wow. And when I finally got out, my mom took me to get that pizza. And I thought to myself, I'm never coming back. That wasn't me saying I'm healed, I'm cured, I don't need any help. That was me saying, I don't care what kind of help I need. It's not going to come from these people, and I'm not doing it.
Wow.
So what's crazy, though, is that, and sorry, let me take that back. I don't mean to use ableist language. What's wild is that now part of my care plan as an adult who deals with madness is that if something goes radically wrong, I have to put myself in a hospital, right? Mm-hmm. Those options still haven't expanded, they haven't grown, because to do otherwise would mean that I leave myself at risk of going to jail, that I leave myself at risk of becoming homeless. and I can't really afford any. I don't like abolition all day. Like prison shouldn't exist. I definitely don't want to go to one. You know?
Right.
But part of what I wanted to ask you about your own career too is like you have made a career writing about young people of color, people who look like you, who live lives like you. What has motivated you to keep doing that? Like you have a book coming out, what, next month?
I have a book coming out in July called Under a Blue Moon, which Under is set Moon. In 37 about a boy who loves science and but has experienced some things with his mom that keeps him sort of self-isolated in the house, so he only goes out on the roof. And, you know, him and his sister build a rocket ship, sort of, you know, and calculate how far the moon is and all of that stuff. And she has decided the only way that you could get over this is to go where the trouble began, and that is under a blue moon where the lighthouse is. So they go on an adventure. And I'll just say real quick, my father is a product of the Jim Crow era. And one day I asked him, what would you have done if you could do anything? And he said, I would have been a, I just went blank, I would have been, what did I say, guys?
Why a pilot?
Astronomer. I don't know why I went, but an astronomer. And I was like, wow. He ended up working for the gas company and digging ditches, and he was the smartest man I ever knew. And I thought, yeah, we could do this. So I did that. So what motivates me? Probably my mom and my dad and my family and being born in this, to me, which is an amazing street in North Philadelphia, where people probably passed by most of our life and they never understood how amazing we were and right, and that we were just, that being ordinary and everyday and African-American was okay, was okay. And so I write about ordinary, right? Everyday African-American kids. And I did that in college from that perspective. And I kept on doing it. And then as I produced more, I had children of all kinds of hues and teachers, but especially African-American kids saying, hey, this is me. This is my story. And I just got, you know, when you wrote to me and I told her, Kimon, I said, you know, I didn't tell you, but that letter you wrote me, I give it to people whenever I'm on the road. And I don't use her name. And she mentions Jason's name in it. I don't use his name. And I say, don't read my resume. She is my resume. Right? Like that if I die tomorrow, I don't want to cry. And I mean it literally. That all the letters I've gotten, I got one from a girl 30 the other day, who said, you changed my life. Like, you can't write a book and think that you're going to get that or deserve it.
Yeah.
Right? That people don't understand that there is something to me spiritual in the act of writing that I didn't know, because I'm like, God got to be doing something, right? And so the fact that people, A, who look like me and who feel like, ah, I got a lifeline here, not always because they were drowning from something bad, right? But, a girl, Raspberry, because she lives in public housing, one day a girl raises her hand and says, my mother is just like Raspberry. She is really neat and super clean. And I thought, how many times does a girl who lives in a project
have to say that?
Is able to say, this is who I am, right? Like, you think you know me? You don't know me. And as a writer, I get to say, you don't know them. And you get to verify, right? By letters or however, saying, yeah, the world doesn't know all of who we are. And then I get letters from kids who might be Caucasian or Indian or Native American, and they say, this is my story. And I'm like, yes, you found yourself in a little black girl who lives in the hood in a world that says that she doesn't exist. She is not important. She will never be anything. And that, my friends, is why people want to ban books. That's all I'm going to say about that.
That's it. Anyway. And that's why I felt you know, people, there have been a couple of moments where people have said things like, you know, this is so intense, or do you feel weird about how much of yourself you put in the book, or do you feel like you've said too much? And I feel an indignant frustration at that, right? Like at this idea that like I could say too much or could put my too much of myself in a book. Like, do you know how badly people need to be seen and need to see themselves? And if you as a writer are holding back from offering them that mirror because you are afraid of what other people might think about how much you've put in the book, then do you understand the true power that lies in what you're doing? And I try not to like over essentialize that power, right? Like it's not gonna solve wars, it's not gonna stop a Mack truck from blowing through your house, right? But it might do something powerful and simple, like give a kid an opportunity to look in the mirror and say, this happened to me, I saw it through the lens of somebody else, and now I know a little bit more about who I am, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's the power of being a writer, if nothing else, is that you get to see people and people get to see themselves.
I think, I don't know, maybe it depends on how you read, because mm-hmm. I think you did this incredible job of telling a lot but not a lot, mm-hmm. right? Because I read it a couple times, and I'm like, wait a minute. I thought it was like, wait, she didn't exactly. Yeah. And so I think that you give us this landscape, and we see this girl grow mm-hmm. and fall in love and be violated, but we don't actually see mm-hmm. the violation, mm-hmm. right? I think that's the beauty of how writers are able to craft the story mm-hmm. so that how did you know when to pull back?
Yeah.
And when to like, just, I'm just gonna, everything yeah. about you is not in this book.
For sure.
For people who think that it is.
Yeah.
But it's enough mm-hmm. that you could fill in the gaps if mm-hmm. you want, and it mm-hmm. depends on what experiences you're bringing. Mm-hmm. So how did you know when to?
A lot of my relationship to writing is trying to understand safety. Like I want people who are reading me, I want readers to feel safe mm-hmm. in my work, even though I may not always feel safe as I'm writing it. I think that, and I worked really hard on this. I spent like a decade trying to refine this, but wow. there's a very thin line between talking about trauma and re-traumatizing your readers. And I've read a couple of books that have re-traumatized me, but then I've also read books that had trauma in it that didn't traumatize me at all, like your books, like Push by Sapphire, right? Like really important critical books that I read at really important critical times of my youth that allowed me to see myself without feeling trapped. And I feel claustrophobic very easily, and I hate to feel trapped in a narrative and anything. And the last thing I want is for anybody who's reading my books to feel like they can't get out.
I didn't feel that way. Like I said, there were times when there was this distance, and it's like you're sitting there and you're telling me like, this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then there were times when I was closer, but I never felt like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's why the prose blocks, too. We talked about this earlier about the structure of the book. There's a lot of space in between each page, and that was really intentional. It was like I wanted to give people the chance to breathe, like just take a breath before we move on to the next thing,
it's
right?
Physically it's physically laid out very well.
Thank you.
Poetic, your use of language and your mastery of language. Is something to behold. I will say that.
Thank you.
And love, like, okay, I know that he was like not the best person for mm-hmm. you, but when it was like falling, I'm mm-hmm. like the falling love person. Uh-huh. It was like, oh,
yeah, yay. That was the most fun
yay.
Part.
Yay! Oh, I did feel a lot of different things. I did when you were, in the facility mm-hmm. and you were sitting there saying, well, how do I get like okay, now I know what I need to do. I feel like I was like listening to a little genius. I'm like, what in the world? She's like, is she really at this age sitting here out slicking these adults
who are
being paid to out slick her, right? Yeah. It's like, so there are all these, I want to ask you this one question about your, there are all these relationships, right? There's a relationship between you and your mother, you and some lovers, you and your trauma, you and the institutions and facilities. So you have all of these things going on. And how did you decide or map that? How did you decide what am I going to, like, my brain is really like this. I'm quite simple, people. I start and I end. It doesn't mean that I don't come off the track or whatever like that. But I imagine that this wasn't the kind of book you can just say, I'm just going to go from here to there.
No, it actually...
Because you jump around age-wise in the text.
Now that I think about it, I actually really forget this anecdote. As I've been having these conversations and people have been asking me a similar question, I should have been using this story. I will now. But my best friend is a scientist, and she's a scientific illustrator. So she illustrates like she literally works for a textbook company, a company called iBiology, and she designs like everything from the cells to whatever. And she came to DC for a couple of days to just sit with me as I had a lot of the pages done, a lot of the writing done. This was about 2 years ago, 2.5. And she just started to draw. And she essentially started to draw this like centrifuge, this like huge tube that was just sort of spinning, and then helped me kind of map out all of these different stories and how they fed back into each other. So in my head, that's literally how the book came to be, is that I like drew a centrifuge, tried to figure out all of these different stories that were going to fuse together ultimately and figure out where they came from. And then I wrote it. I had to draw it.
Like the Russian stacking dolls you talk about.
Yeah, and I'm obsessed with Russian dolls. So Russian dolls were a huge image in my head as I was writing it. When you said it on the phone yesterday, I was like, oh my God, she understands me.
Well, you talk about the Russian stacking dolls.
Yeah.
And I can't explain this part, but the looping. And the book does sort of loop. I got to one point and I was like, I thought I read that already. Where is it? And then I read it again. I'm like, oh, it's the Russian stacking dolls. It's all in a loop. Right? And so...
Because that's the way life works, right? Life happens in a loop. I mean, even, you know, if you think about entropy and death. Exactly. Yeah. Like, you get to the end of your life and it doesn't actually... If you believe in spirituality and that kind of stuff, then you believe that your life then becomes material in some other realm, and then the space that you used to occupy then gets occupied by somebody else. It's all very whimsical and cyclical, but that's kind of how it works. And I wanted to go back to something earlier. You were talking about writing about the love and the heartbreak and all this stuff. Writing about the love was my favorite part. I was so excited to write about it because it felt like a real exercise in doing something that is very hard to do. It is very hard to look back at something that you really dislike, to look back at a relationship that you no longer feel strongly about or don't value in the same way, and be able to identify what you loved about that person, what that felt like, and really be able to articulate it. And it was a challenge I posed to myself. I was like, if I'm going to write this book, I have to, for them to understand how bad the heartbreak was, they have to understand how deep the love was and what it felt like.
And I just thought it was going to work. Even though you start off early in the book saying that you wanted to die or something.
Yeah.
I just thought, I just wanted to work. But I wasn't disappointed when it didn't work, right? It was just, I was along for that ride. I wasn't disappointed when it didn't work. Maybe a tiny bit.
Yeah.
But maybe a tiny bit. But it... You did such a great job of peeling back the layers of that relationship and letting us see just the tiniest morsels of why you fell in love and how you fell out of love, or at least how the relationship sort of implodes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm mm-hmm. telling you all, but I'm not telling you.
Yeah, she's very good.
So how it implodes, right? Yeah. And your role in it. And I thought that was really good because yeah. we don't always see our role in things. I think we see your role in a lot of this,
mm-hmm.
not to say blame, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
But we see how it impacts you, what mm-hmm. you think about
mm-hmm.
mental health, your mother,
mm-hmm.
the institutions, dating,
mm-hmm.
The abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it all folds up into one really nice, cute little package.
That is so
actually quite tiny. I really love this little baby. You can just hold it like this.
Real fast.
All the time.
Like, where did you get the courage
Ooh.
For that title? Because I looked at it and I thought, what's that saying?
What does that mean? You know.
Well, what is it saying? I'm like, what? But now I like it because I can pronounce it.
Yeah. You know, the courage came I'm a little shady at my core. I can't help myself. But there are a couple people, systems that I'm shading in this book, right? One of them being the system of whiteness that categorizes who is allowed to own what phrases, what conversations, how they get to be used, etc. And because dyscalculia is a term that is extremely scientific, that has almost no representation in regular pop culture and media, it's supposed to be a thing that is exclusive and off limits. Like, you're not supposed to use medical terminology to talk about anything but the medical thing as it is, unless you are a famous white writer. And I was like, you know what? I, as a person with dyscalculia, get to call this book whatever the fuck I want to call it. And I have decided to turn dyscalculia into a metaphor. And there are going to be some people who are mad at me. The New York Times was slightly mad at me. That's okay.
Yeah.
Just a smidgen. But at the end of the day, I feel really satisfied with my choice. Because I really like this metaphor. And I think it's really helpful. I think it's really helpful to think about inability to execute on arithmetic and mathematics as not just a mathematical thing, but also as a social thing, as a structural thing, as a cultural thing, because that is functionally how it works, mm-hmm. right? People don't just have dyscalculia. People are not taught how to think about math outside of the framework by which we are taught to think about math. And those people grow the rest of their lives thinking that they don't understand math. It doesn't make sense, that it can't be for them. And I feel similarly about this book and about the title. Like, it belongs to me, it's mine, it gets to be whatever I decide that it is, because I decided. And I spent a couple of days thinking to myself, I was like, somebody is going to be really upset. Somebody who also has dyscalculia is going to be like, fuck this bitch, I hate her, how dare she take this thing that really, really afflicts me and turn it into a literary term. But I just felt like that person is allowed to have their feelings and I'm going to do what I want because the white writers are.
Well, what feelings did your publisher have when you came to them with that title?
Oh, they were good to go.
Good.
Yeah, they were good to go. I mean, mostly because they trust me, which is very nice. I don't know
that
why they would trust
nice.
Me with a lot of money. I don't. You know, trust is not usually part of the game, but with One World,
nice.
That's what I got. They trust me. And honestly, I'm gonna keep it real. I don't think that they thought this book was going to, like, do very much. You know what I mean? Because I got a 2-book deal, and the other book is what I'm working on now, and it was supposed to come first. And they thought originally that this was going to be a poetry collection. And I think most publishers, when it comes to poetry, they're like, girl, we don't know what the hell is going on. Do whatever you want. And so originally it had been titled Dyscalculia since before I gave it to them. So they knew what the title was, but like I said, I think they were just like, whatever, girl, we'll get to it when we get to it. And then I asked them to flip the order because in my head, I just knew that this book should come first.
Okay.
And I mean, there wasn't a lot that they could do about it then. They'd already agreed to take it. But the compromise that I made was on the subtitle.
Okay.
And it felt
Which
like
I
a,
love.
Yeah, I really like that subtitle too, and it felt like a good compromise because I do want people to buy the book.
Right.
Like, it's a marketing choice.
And the reviews have been amazing.
Yeah, the reviews have been pretty good. Pretty good. We'll talk about the one that I didn't love later, because I need you to, like, give me some advice on how to deal with bad reviews.
Yeah, but you've been reviewed in some places. I haven't. So even a bad review in a major publication might not be so bad.
Okay, that's fair. It's easier to think about it that way.
Did they spell your name right?
Did they spell my name right? They did not fail to spell my name right. They failed at some other things. I think we have time to take questions now.
So the title is actually what brought me here,
because
I am a math teacher,
and
I want to best, and I think dyscalculia just in general is completely underdiagnosed, and like with dyslexia, there's actually a certification, and I'm very passionate about, like, I need to know more about dyscalculia so I can best support my students. I can't, like, hardly find any information about it. There's no certifications for it. I think there's one in, like, the UK, but nothing here. So my question for you is, if I suspect a student has it, or if there are a handful that are diagnosed with it, how best to support them? Because my conversation with my students is, this isn't math. Like, I don't want you to think that math is all, like, this crazy, insane subject that you can't grasp, that you're not good at, you know, as they tell me all the time. It's logic. I want you to think about how, like, to logically think, because, no, you're never going to use this again in real life, like, especially my seniors. But I'm like, but I want you to think about, like, how these pieces tie together and have this pattern that just kind of keeps happening in the process, and, like, oh, and, like, working backwards and things like that. So my thought is, like, it was like, I don't want you to think of math as, like, this thing, but it's logical. It's planning and things like that. So my question for you is, how best to support those kids diagnosed and undiagnosed?
So I would say, for those who are diagnosed, usually, based on my research, it is usually a comorbidity, and they're usually struggling with something else, like bipolar disorder or dyslexia or et cetera. So for your diagnosed students, I would sort of just, like, start there with that knowledge that, like, they're dealing with something else, probably a mood disorder, probably some other learning disorder that is, like, preventing them from even being able to tap into, like, the basic kind of set of logic that you're setting up for them. And the reason why I say that more uniquely about diagnosed students instead of undiagnosed is because if they've been diagnosed, then that means that likely their symptoms were significant enough to lead them into a space of into a diagnostic space, whereas usually undiagnosed people, their symptoms don't seem pronounced enough for them to have kind of any disruption. And for your undiagnosed students, I would say, I think, like, thinking about math outside of arithmetic is really helpful, right? Just thinking about math as everyday logic is really, really helpful to, like, kind of getting past the thing that says that, like, math looks like this, is like this, and it's really hard. Science opened up a lot for me in math. Not like using math in science, but, like, for instance, when I failed pretty much every math and science course up until 11th grade, and then I took pre-calc and I got an A, which was crazy, and then I did really well in calculus as well. And I think part of that is because when you get into pre-calc, you're not just dealing with numbers, you're dealing with figures and you're dealing with structures. And something about that helped me. And so for your younger students, for your 9th graders and 10th graders who are probably about to go into trig or pre-trig, maybe it's helpful for them to start thinking about pre-calc. One book that I read that was really helpful for me was Einstein's Dreams. At that time, a teacher gave it to me. And there's not a lot of math in it, and there's not a lot of science in it, but there's a lot of logic, right? I mean, just an entire page of being like, this person did this, and then this person did that, and then that followed this, and this followed that, and trying to understand, like, why is this even here? Like, why is it even relevant? Why are we reading about this sequence of actions? And then helping them realize what that adds up to. So I guess the answer is just, like, putting it in a different box for them that seems a little less intimidating, and seeing if there's something in it that they can kind of tease out.
Hi, y'all. Thanks for being here and having this conversation. So I'm asking a question in anticipation of reading the book, which I have not read yet. So forgive me if there's, like, a super obvious answer. But it kind of piggybacks on this question around the idea of logic. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited about the ways that Black women misuse mm-hmm. math and mm-hmm. misuse the logic mm-hmm. of math. Mm-hmm. Because in many ways, our existence and survival and joy is illogical.
Right.
So I wonder if I can just invite you to think about the illogic or think about misusing math.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost exactly what this is about. You kind of knocked it on the head, right? It's about the way that math shows up in our world and the way that we missee it, misunderstand it, misuse it, right, on our way towards whatever else we're getting at. And so in the story that I'm telling the character, which is me, because it's a memoir, which is really frustrating to keep thinking, because I didn't intend to write a memoir. Anyway, the character, on top of generally like being bad at math, also is making these choices and these decisions that don't seem to add up to the outcome that she's hoping for. But in the end, through this sort of like misuse and misunderstanding of math, she still ends up exactly where she was supposed to end up mm-hmm. without having to necessarily like correct the math. The math mm-hmm. doesn't get edited. The math just sort of exists. Mm-hmm. This is the mistake that was made, and that mistake brought you to point B. And then a mathematics is done, a calculation is done at point B, perhaps a misuse of math, and then once again it lands you at point C. So I think about it often, and some of this is complicated. It's complicated to talk about this in these terms because even the concept of misuse, when we're thinking about Black people, is just tough to wrap our heads around. Like, is it a misuse, right? Like, could it possibly be? Or like, is math so expansive that like you can make two lefts and end up right? I don't know if that makes sense, but like there is a way of thinking about these concepts that doesn't require that we are on the same page with whiteness and with the way that whiteness understands something. And so what you never hear me talk about in the book is like solving or curing my dyscalculia. That's not an option. What you hear is about me dealing with my bipolar disorder. And through dealing with bipolar disorder, I'm able to make different calculations. But those calculations are not necessarily correct or incorrect, and they don't get labeled as such. They just are. And the world kind of has to envelop those choices and wrap around me for me to feel safe. So at the end, when I'm doing math on these sheets that I should have been doing in third grade, it's not me trying to prove that I have bested math and that I get it now, but trying to prove that by doing the wrong math, by doing math in these wrong ways, that I actually taught myself what math was so that I was able to actually get it done. Does that make sense? It's all very complex.
Would you talk about your writing process? Mm-hmm. You mentioned, both of you, about getting sort of ideas from your lives mm-hmm. and then sort of quickly coming up with ideas. But what is your actual process? Mm-hmm. And how do you go about taking all of those things and starting to put it down and move forward with it?
I think showing up is part of the process. Mm-hmm. Do you write? Mm-hmm. Or do you want
Not
to write?
Enough.
Well, that's part of the showing up, I think. So I write about 5 hours a day, 3 hours on weekends. For most of my career, I wrote like 3 hours a day mm-hmm. and not on weekends.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the process. I got stuck at one point, and part of getting stuck, I still was producing. So most of the world doesn't know what I'm talking about. I still was producing, putting out work, but But my process became more focused on the goal, right? And so that's where I got stuck. I kept thinking about the end, like, mm-hmm. oh, what awards am I going to win? And I had never thought about that, but that really, what are my awards? And so I had to say, what's your process? Mm-hmm. And I went to somebody to help me figure this out. They're like, what is your process? Every day I get up and write. Okay,
You don't control the war chairs you play, right? You don't control whether your publisher or your editor is going to even like this book. Mm-hmm. The only thing you control is you show up. Mm-hmm. And when my head would start going like, I would just say, what's your process, Sharon G. Flake? I show up and I write. And little by little, that angst, because mm-hmm. I have anxiety, mm-hmm. would just sort of settle down, right? And it would come back up and it would settle down. And mm-hmm. now it's sort of, and part of it is letting other people read your work and getting okay with feedback mm-hmm. so that you know where the holes are, mm-hmm. right? Where you've taken some giant leap and nobody knows what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So that is also part of the process. And don't worry about publishing so much. I run into people all the time who say, Sharon Flake, how do you get published? I'm like, oh, do you write? No, I'm thinking about it though. This is America, people. Your cat can be published, right? And if you're a writer or author, you really want to probably be published more than once if you can do it. So that's sort of my process.
Yeah, I would say, so my process for this book looked a lot different from my process for writing in for all the process is different for all the different writings I do. So I do mm-hmm. long form nonfiction. Those are essays. I write poetry, and then I write memoir and memoiristic kind of stuff. And for the poetry, it's very ad hoc. I mean, I write more poems in a year than I expect to, but I don't think that I get more than like 5 or 6 good ones a year. Like, wow. That's just kind of what it is. That's not true. This year I already got 5 or 6, so I might end up with 12. But that was because I went to a workshop. I don't always do that every year. With poetry, I let it be ad hoc. Like, it kind of is what it is. I read all the time. I aspire to read all the time. Whether or not I actually am able to do that depends on life. But I'm always thinking about what I want to be reading. I'm always thinking about the last thing that I read. That's a key part of my process. And honestly, like, if I can spend enough time reading, I can put in the same amount of time writing. But that assumes that I get time to do either. So yeah, it's very ad hoc. For this book, it's a book that basically starts as a shell and then has to be plugged in. And so I was writing maybe 10 or 15 pages a day of just narrative, like, this is what happened, just like straight up. And then going back to it the next day and then poeticizing the lines a little bit more, beefing it up, turning it up. The way that I think about poetry and the way that I think about memoir is that the line essentially, in poetry, the line is like already turned up, right? And sometimes you gotta like turn it down. In memoir, the line is very flat when you first get to it, and then you gotta turn it up, you gotta dial it up. That's what poetry does to regular language, it dials it up. And so that's kind of what I think of as my process in memoir, is like leave, come back, dial up the language, and then I move on to something else. But yeah, it's all very different. And something I said the other day, I don't know if you'll agree with this, but I think that we might put too much emphasis on process, actually. And also I say this as somebody who knows a lot of writers, they be lying. Like, they write, like, I'm sure you've heard a lot of people talk about process and they say they write 5 hours a day. The only person I believe is Sharon Flake. Like, most people are not writing 5 hours a day, right? They're writing where they can and kind of hoping that it makes sense. And I think that if you're experiencing writer's block or something like that, that's probably because you're not doing something that you need to be doing for your body or for your spirit. So I say to like younger writers, if you're in school all day and you've got 6 classes and then you're like, how come I can't write a poem? It's probably because you need to go to sleep.
Yeah.
You probably need to go to bed, right? And if you're not a college student, but you're an older person and you have pain in your body and you're wondering to yourself, I can't write, it's probably because you're in pain, right? Like, let's deal with the fact that you're in pain and then maybe the writing will come. So that's a big part of my process, is trying to like listen to my body and figure out what is in the way of me getting to the writing. And because I've been on tour, it's been exhaustion, and it's just gonna have to be what it is.
Well, I do write 5 hours a day.
That's what I'm saying. You're the only person I believe.
But here's what happened.
Yeah.
When I talk about being stuck, publishing houses, I tell kids all the time, they're like any other organization.
Yeah.
I got an editor. I didn't think she liked my work. I had been in the business like 10 years. So, you know, how I got in this business is really the first book won a big award.
Yeah.
And it was by Disney and they were starting a new line. So it was like, boom, the first editor that saw it bought it.
Right.
Right. So I didn't have a lot of like, you know, canceled stuff in my background. I just didn't. So first of all, it was time.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Everything was like, boom, 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 boom. Right. I got all these contracts. They didn't know what I was writing. I just handed them what I wanted. Right? That was my life. I was traveling and like, boom. Because guess what? At some point, you're going to hit the wall no matter what.
Right.
So I didn't think she liked my work. It turns out she really, I think, did like my work. But the feedback she gave me was in a way I had never received before. It took me 10 years to realize that. But by then, my head was spiraling, and I'm thinking, she doesn't like my work. And it was like, it just went down, but I'm still producing, but now instead of producing one every year and a half, it's like one every three or four. But I'm still out there, I'm still going on stuff. And at one point, I go, this sounds really silly, but I go to a hypnotist, and I like, listen, get me out of this thing, right? But he had a little machine, and he had bunches of people in different rooms, and I'm like, I'm gonna be hypnotized by a machine. I don't think
what's
so.
Going on?
But then I found somebody that dealt with athletes. One day I woke up, I think it was God, and it said, you know what? You need somebody that deals with athletes people who are stuck. And Lord, I found one in Pittsburgh, and she was the one that talked about process. But by the time that happened, I was into, and I had never been into this, okay, it's got to be, I got to win like an award. It's got to be, when I did produce the book, it's got to win the top award. And that book produced 4-star reviews, Kirk's top 10 book. It produced all this stuff. And you know what I said? And this is so not like me, really. It's not people. Basically, my head was like, it failed. That's how, right?
Yeah.
And so when all that's in your head, how do you write? And I was still writing well, but it took the whole thing about, okay, figure out this process thing. That helped me to say, okay, you always just love to write. It wasn't the end thing. It wasn't the goal. It was just, you just love to write, to do good with your work. And so remember that. And so you're right. When people and I realized also when I got, it wasn't just that woman, that editor. I was tired. I was traveling all the time. I had a kid. I'm writing all the time. But I didn't realize. And then I felt like I owed them money, right? They had paid me money. And my brain kept saying, well, girl, you owe them money.
Listen.
You better produce something here.
Listen.
Right? So all of this stuff and community. You're in community in a way I never was. And so I realized I was also on an island by myself. Yeah. I knew all these writers in the marketplace, sort of. But I was on an island by myself.
Right.
And I had to go to a couple of people and say, hey, would you read this? Or start to try to build community. Because you probably are an extrovert. I'm not really. I might appear to be one. I'm sort of in between.
Yeah.
And so you look around and say, so you need community for people who don't want other people to read your work. You really do need it. You need to not be, and you need to know when, when you're tired, when your brain is saying, okay, you keep fooling around, come on, I'm going to fix you.
But community is super important because you need people who are going to push you and who are going to look at your work and say, not here.
It's not really a question. And I just want to say thank you so much for putting yourselves out there. I'm new to Philly. Well, not really new, but kind of new. And I am an educator. I'm a supervisor of education in the prison setting. So some of the things that you were speaking about, I see it all day, every day. And so it gives me another platform to bring in different types of books into the institution so that they can identify with the characters. And I just want to say thank you, ladies. And I really, really, really enjoy, you know, you all speaking about your experiences.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.